Then tell me if this was covered on an early season pod. Maybe I was off that week. Maybe I missed it. Have you discussed the smoke machines and strobe lights in the Blue Jays clubhouse?
I don't think so. They're a sight to see.
How did you not mention this to me? I witnessed them in action for the first time on Monday.
Wow. So you had not seen them in action?
I hadn't seen it. Blue Jays don't win a lot of games.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
So I hadn't seen it yet. So I walk into the clubhouse after they thump the Kansas City Royals on Canada Day. Walking into the club, man. Strobe lights are going. The lights are off. Like a substantial amount of smoke filling the clubhouse.
Yeah. And if you're looking, like in our roles after the game, we're often looking for a specific player. If you're looking, it can be actually hard to find the player in the fog. I don't think that's the intended purpose, but it definitely is one of the consequences.
Might have to file a BBWAA complaint over that. Like, how are you supposed to talk to anybody now at their locker after a game? But like the thing that stuck me was that like planning went into this because these strobe lights are in the ceiling. Like somebody had to think about how they were going to install these strobe lights. And it's not like a little bit of smoke coming out of like a little machine from somebody's bar mitzvah or something. Like there's smoke throughout the entire clubhouse. Somebody spent money and thought about this.
It doesn't feel like steam necessarily, but it doesn't smell like smoke. I'm not exactly sure. Just fog of some sort. I don't know how you get that.
Smoke machine technology these days is huge. So yeah, the Blue Jays, they're building that culture, man. The young players are building their culture. They're giving out championship belts to the best position player and best pitcher. They're having raves after wins. It strikes me like how different it is than when the clubhouse was kind of run by Josh Donaldson and Jose Bautista, right?
Yeah, very different. I think when you look back at those kind of 17, 18 years after the team was good, but before they fully entered this rebuild, there was so much frustration in the clubhouse at all times. And we kind of got used to that. It happened so gradually. And, you know, you kind of understand the frustration of the players so much at that point because they were expected to be good and they weren't. But then it's so different this year. Yeah. And I guess the fog machine would be an example of that because that certainly wasn't around when the Blue Jays were, you know, 10 games under 500 in 2017 and they're trying to scrap their way back into the wild card. There's no way they had fog machines around.
No, I wonder if it gets old after a while or in a year, like if the Blue Jays are good again and they win like 90 times, and it's like, oh, we gotta fire up the fog machine again.
I wonder if they'd look for variety. I don't think the celebrations would get old because, I think each win, there's a little bit of a high for players if they come off the field having won.
Absolutely. This is, of course, at the letters brought to you by the all-new 2019 Ford Ranger. That's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. The Blue Jays playing a bit better baseball lately. It's a bit more watchable baseball. Like, they're still going to lose a lot of games, this team. Like, they still might lose 100. We'll see. Because they just don't have the talent to compete with some of the league's best teams. And they have a lot of games coming up against the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Astros, the Twins. I mean, they're going to play some good baseball teams here and they're probably going to lose a lot. But I would say that the baseball the Blue Jays are playing right now is just more interesting from a fan's perspective, I would say. Like, I think that you can actually like stay with these games, whereas maybe earlier in the season fans were looking for the remote at times. Now you're saying, oh well, you know, Kevin Biggio is about to come up and he's been having like really good plate appearances, and hey, here's Vlad in a spot with, you know, a couple of runners on, and you know, like, it's just, I think, a lot more watchable now than it has been.
Yeah, and I haven't gone through the exercise of trying to find the low point of Blue Jays lineups from 2019, but I am sure that there was like an April the 15th lineup where Alan Hansen and Socrates Brito were all basically hitting in the lineup together. And of course, at that point, you're not really watching much. Like, it's almost like a spring training game after the regulars emerge. Like, it's really only the diehards who would be interested at that point. And I think still largely this is a season where mostly it'll be diehard fans watching. But if you have Kevin Biggio and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. not only in the major leagues, but hitting well and contributing, Danny Jansen with some big hits mixed in there, starting to come around a little bit, that's when you start to get a lot more out of it as a viewer, whether even just from an interest standpoint, because you know they're not going to win a lot.
That era, the Brito Hansen era, feels like 100 years ago, man.
Like, and that's good for the Jays. That should feel like 100 years ago.
Yeah. You look at, you know, the Canada Day lineup, you know, Eric Sogard leading off, who's like obviously been having this like remarkable out of nowhere campaign. So that's a fun guy to watch right now. And he works a great plate appearance top of the lineup. Guerrero, Gurriel, Biggio. That's the future of the club in the heart of the order. You're watching those guys hit. Randall Grichuk, the Blue Jays are invested on this guy. He's going to be around. And hey, he comes up with, you know, four RBI singles on Canada Day. Some signs of turning it around. The ball still comes off his bat. An extremely high rate of speed.
Randall Grichuk has three hits and three RBIs today. Randall Grichuk has four hits and four RBIs today. What a day for Grichuk.
He had the hardest hit ball in that game on Canada Day. And hey, Glenn Sparkman started that game. There were some hard hit balls. And Randall Grichuk had the hardest hit one. They got Rowdy Tellez after him, a threat to leave the yard at all times. It's always fun to watch like a big slugger at the plate, you know, the big lefty masher at the plate. And then you got Teoscar Hernandez, who's an entertaining player to watch. And then Freddy Galvis, who goes deep twice in that game.
Lifts a drive to deep center. Hamilton going back, turns, gone! Galvis goes back-to-back with Teoscar, and it's 4-0.
Like you said, Danny Jansen, who is, you know, certainly struggling this year at the big league level and not producing offensively the way a lot of people thought that he would, considering his minor league numbers, but a guy who still comes up with some big plate appearances.
There he goes. Swinging a drive.
Guy's fun to watch, no batting gloves, you know, he's got glasses. Like, it's an interesting lineup to watch right now, I think.
Yeah, and that's really the first time that we've been able to say that this year. I think so much of it coincides with Lourdes Gurriel Jr.'s hot streak, because in the course of this Blue Jays rebuild, they have found some useful players like a Trent Thornton, but they hadn't found a star anywhere.
Yeah.
And with Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who knows? I mean, he had 1 month and we're halfway into his season and he's had his struggles already this year, but you're seeing flashes of a player who could be a star, and that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, let's have the Lourdes Gurriel Jr. conversation, because it's so hard to tell what is real with him. Like, when you talk about a hot streak, like, you're talking about like a 6 week hot streak. You're talking about like a month and a half now, and it's just not stopping.
Lourdes Gurriel Jr. ties the game. Boy, does it feel good to be back. Lourdes points to the heavens as he crosses the plate with his first home run of the season.
Three games since he's come back from Buffalo, and a home run in each and every one of them. Next pitch is lined into left field. That's a base hit. It's a four-hit day for Lourdes Gurriel.
Lourdes Gurriel Jr. at the plate, and he jolts one high and deep out to left field. You can forget it! First pitch to Lourdes is hammered. Deep left field. Goodwin going back, looking up. It's gone!
But you look at some of the peripheral numbers, right? And you look at a high batting average on balls in play, and you look at the fact that he's still not walking a ton, and the fact that he still expands the zone, and he still swings and misses a lot. I mean, he's just got such good bat-to-ball skills on pitches in the zone. He can barrel up baseballs that are all over, you know, different quadrants of the strike zone. It's not like, you know, he has this hole in his swing and, you know, the upper half of the zone or whatever. Like, he can get his bat around because he's got those long arms. He's got a really smooth, fluid swing. So he generates a lot of exit velocity like that and a lot of different pitches, but the discipline still isn't quite there and the patience isn't still quite there. And we've seen him, you know, have some really low lows at the plate to go along with these high highs. And it's kind of hard to look at the batting average on balls in play over these 6 weeks and say, well, that's going to continue. But you look at the amount of home runs that he's hitting. It's like, well, hey, yeah, you're going to have a great BABIP on balls that you hit over the fence. So like, it's kind of just hard to gauge, like, surely he's not, you know, this good, but can he be pretty good? It looks like it, but you kind of have to see it over a lot more plate appearances.
Without a doubt. And this is where it's still just exploratory and figuring out what's happening here with Gurriel Jr. Yeah, to your point on the BABIP, it's been above 380 in May and in June.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. I mean, you don't see any players doing that. So you know that his batting average is going to come down, with it the OBP, with it the slugging. So that's fine. He's not going to keep this up. But he had 10 home runs in June. And even in today's power-filled game, you definitely don't have a lot of guys capable of hitting 10 home runs in a month. You just don't see that happen very often. So I think that that tells us something. Certainly he's not going to hit 60 every year. I mean, that's no one does that. So it's not a sustainable pace either. But you do know that he has the ability to go off and carry a team offensively for a month. And we didn't even know that a month ago. So that's something that we've learned and seen from Gurriel Jr. that's pretty impressive.
It's kind of remarkable to me that he's still getting pitches to hit, because he really hasn't shown that he's always going to lay off of like the ball way below the zone, like the slider in the dirt, or like the sometimes like the fastball in the other batter's box. You know, like he still takes some crazy swings at pitches that are way outside the zone, but like maybe he's just going to be a really streaky hitter like that. And the question for me then would be, can you have a winning club? Like, can you have a contending club with a really streaky hitter like that? You know, this is like an imperfect exercise, but over his two seasons now as a big leaguer, he's gotten to 454 plate appearances. So not yet a full season if you're healthy, but I don't know, say you miss a month with an injury or something and maybe you're in and out of the lineup. Like, you could say that's a full season for the purpose of this exercise. 113 games, 454 plate appearances, 860 OPS. And that's with the lows, right? And that's with the weeks in the majors where he was lost. So if you're that streaky, and we all remember the multi-hit game streak that he went on last season, and now we're seeing something somewhat similar now, it all ends up in the aggregate looking pretty good. It's just, as a club over the course of a season, can you ride those highs and lows and be okay?
You can, without a doubt. I think with that kind of production, and yeah, to the point that you made there, that stat line is really impressive.
Yeah.
296 average, 527 slug with 25 homers. Like, that's really, really good production. So I think, yeah, no matter how you get there, if that's the end result, you take it. Even if you go 0 for a month, if you have hot streaks like the one he had, and you end up at that line, you're happy with it. And it's a question of surrounding him with other players in that batting order. And the other thing is, with that offensive production, if he's able to even come close to an 860 OPS, then he can stay in left field, because that's great. You don't have to worry about him being a second baseman again. He can just stay in left and roll with that.
Well, yeah, don't forget about the elite left field defense that you are getting. Don't forget about the fact that nobody can run on him.
Right. Yeah.
Like, the assist numbers that he's put up, having played the outfield for a month and a half, are like absurd.
Now he hits a ground ball fair down the third baseline and into left field. It goes off that short wall. Gurriel picks it up. Good throw into second base on a hop. The tag by Biggio, and they got him. Voit the lead off of second. The 1-0 pitch to Hicks. Swung on line into left field. The base hit. Gurriel on it quickly. Gets it on a hop and comes up firing. Voit runs through the stop sign, and he is meat cake. Luke Voit thrown out by six steps by Lourdes Gurriel Jr. to end the inning.
And he's going to find a hole. Holt is getting the wave. Here comes the throw from Gurriel to the plate in plenty of time. What a play by Lourdes Gurriel Jr.
That's his fifth outfield assist. He's playing in his 26th game in left field.
And of course, like, teams are testing him and saying, oh, okay, so you've got this middle infielder didn't work and you stuck him in left. We're going to run on him. Man, guy makes great throws from left. Like, StatCast measuring them up over 90 miles an hour, and they're accurate. They are on a line. Like, they're not, you know, dragging Danny Jansen like way up the first or third base line.
It's such a contrast compared to, say, you know, the middle of May when he was in the minor leagues. And at that point, he hadn't hit in the majors. He was hitting okay in the minors, and he basically had the yips. So he wasn't throwing well at all. So you had a second baseman who couldn't throw and wasn't hitting. Now you have a left fielder who's crushing it defensively and offensively. I mean, that's a huge turnaround in a short period of time.
It's kind of the success story of the Blue Jays season to this point.
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, in terms of like plate discipline and in terms of patience, I would say is Kevin Biggio, who is having just remarkable plate appearances for a guy who's going through like his first 30-some games. What is he at now? 32 games as a big leaguer. His first 32 games seeing major league pitching, and you just like, you look at some of the, you know, the chase rate, which is super, super low, the not expanding the strike zone, seen a first pitch ball in more than half of his plate appearances as a big leaguer.
Wow.
As a rookie, right? Like as a guy you would expect to be getting challenged. He got himself into 2-3-0 counts in that Kansas City Royals series that was just played on Canada Day weekend. And he got a green light in both of them from Charlie Montoya, which tells you how much this Blue Jays coaching staff like trusts him, right? That he's looking in and getting the sign of like, you're 3-0, you can have a green light, rookie.
3-0 green light, and that's a base hit down the right field line. Two more runs will score. Biggio on his way to second and in there with a double.
Well, as good as Cavan has been, he just continually impresses you with his at-bats. A 3-0 count. Veteran hitters will overswing on a 3-0 count. Not Cavan Biggio.
You've played 32 games. Like, that's how much they trust his approach and his discipline and his pitch recognition and his ability to make really good contact on pitches that are in the zone, because he is pairing that discipline with a really high hard hit rate. Is it going to continue forever? Who knows, right? Like, is there a slump coming for him? Maybe. Does, you know, do pitchers adjust to him just like they're going to adjust to Lourdes Gurriel Jr.? Sure. But you can be so, so encouraged with just the plate approach that you've seen from Cavan Biggio.
Yeah, without a doubt. And if Gurriel is the biggest success story this season, I think Biggio is probably number two on that list for the Blue Jays. And, you know, both young potential fixtures for this lineup. So you look at the production in essentially his first month in the major leagues, he already has 20 walks. I mean, you prorate that, which is a dangerous game, but if you were to prorate that over a full season, you're looking at 100 walks on base of 370. He's showing you some power. He's showing you some speed, some versatility. I mean, this is really the dream. And if you've got someone who is already drawing these walks when you're a rookie, we saw with Vlad Jr., umpires don't necessarily give rookies a lot of borderline calls. You have to imagine that as Biggio gets more comfortable, learns the strike zone more, and umpires maybe start to give him a few more calls on the edge, then that could even increase. So again, that's an optimistic scenario. There are also scenarios where he steps back and can't sustain this, but there's a lot to be encouraged by with Biggio. And for a guy who maybe a year and a half ago, we were like, yeah, it's, you know, kind of hard to see what he really becomes.
Yeah.
Now it's easy to project him. I mean, I think at this point, he's starting every game for the rest of this season and into next season. And you just, if you're the Blue Jays, you hope that he continues on this pace, because it's the pace of a very good major league player.
You mentioned Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in there as well. And that's a guy who has stepped into the big leagues and not quite replicated the production that he put up in the minor leagues. Although that's like an insane standard to hold. Like, hey, just show up in the big leagues and walk more than you strike out and like barrel everything at 120 miles an hour. Still hitting the ball awfully hard. I think he's just adjusting to major league life. I think we all expect that next year is going to be a big year for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but, you know, just now that he's gotten over this year of, you know, getting to the majors and learning it and this and that and the other, but there very well could be like a 3-week stretch coming for him in the second half where like he goes bananas. It wouldn't be surprising to see that at all. He's going to go to the home run derby. Maybe that's what he needs. Maybe he needs a little home run derby. Maybe it's like the opposite of like the tired narrative of like, oh, guys go to the home run derby and screw up their swings. Yeah, he hit like 2 home runs in June. So like maybe this is actually what he needs to go on a second half tear.
And you could easily imagine a second half tear from Vlad Jr. I mean, I've been saying it constantly and I still just would never be surprised when you have that kind of power and that kind of plate coverage to see him go off and that kind of plate discipline. So clearly, you know, as you're saying, he hasn't replicated the numbers that he had in the minor leagues. And he went for, I think it was a few weeks there without a home run before homering recently. But you just know that the talent is there, and it's easy to forget he's 20 years old. Cavan Biggio and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. are like 4 years older than Vlad. and Vlad still has an OPS plus, as we record this, of 103. So he's still been better than the league average. And that's a league that includes Mike Trout and Lourdes and all these Mookie Betts, all these great hitters. So he's holding his own, and there's room for him to do a lot more than that.
Yeah, he walks a lot, right, is kind of the thing that's propping that up. I guess the expectations were so high,
yeah.
Right? So, like, if he was just a regular prospect who came up to, you know, and just had this, you know, 750 OPS, this, like, you know, above 100 OPS plus, I mean, you'd be like, yeah, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome to the big leagues, right? It's because he's the number one prospect in baseball, and there's so much potential there. But, yeah, just 20 years old. Yeah. You know, like he's probably still growing into some of the power that he'll feature, right? Like even just as a human being, like I know he's already like very, very large, but he'll probably gain some muscle over the years. He's still 20. He's, you know, he might still be, you know, packing on some pounds, right? Like he's going to get bigger. At third base, it's been hit or miss. You know, there's been some plays that maybe, as Wilner would say, a little too much chalance. Or not enough chalance, or whatever right. He would say. I can't, only Wilner.
It's not the that. Right amount of chalance, whatever it is.
on the chalance level, not where you want to be.
No.
That's what this season's about, man, is breaking these guys into the major leagues and giving them like learning experiences and letting them grow and letting them experience things for the first time. Like it can only help them going forward if they kind of get their errors out of the way and they get their learning experiences out of the way now. You know, I think you're seeing that from a lot of these young players.
Aside from Vladdy, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Biggio. I mean, obviously those guys seem like fixtures, and Bo Bichette apparently, hopefully, could be up here with them relatively soon, which would add to that group. But beyond those guys, do you see anyone who's along with them on that level of, hey, these are really core pieces with this team?
No. Yeah. You know, I think it's a question of, like, is Teoscar Hernandez, like, a part of this team long-term? You know, like, is Randall Grichuk? I mean, Randall Grichuk is, like, contractually, so probably, but, like, how do those guys kind of fit in? That's what's kind of interesting, right, is the guys who are, you know, kind of in their, you know, you don't want to say that they're in their primes, but kind of, you know, late 20s, right, like, kind of getting there. You know, how are those guys going to fit on this team going forward? Then, you know, you think about a guy like Anthony Alford, right? Yeah. Like, how does he fit into that outfield mix? Look, if Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is like your left fielder now, right now you got Teoscar Hernandez playing center and Randall Grichuk playing right. Where's Anthony Alford fit in? Because he's kind of part of this rebuild, maybe more so than like Teoscar Hernandez would be long term.
I think if Alford can hit, then he'll force his way into the mix somehow, because there will always be enough injuries or they can trade someone. To this point, Alford hasn't hit enough to push his way into the major leagues. And some of that was injury. Some of that was the slow start he had last year and the confidence issues he tried to regain and struggled with that. And he just, to this point, hasn't completely hit. So it's no longer really a question of reps. He's had his chances. I know he had the late start because of the football career, but he has a chance here to earn his way to the major leagues. And it isn't happening right now.
I just wonder if he just needs a little bit of big league rope and just like see how it goes, right? Like at some point, don't you kind of have to like test him in the majors? Like, don't you just give him like a month of everyday reps in the majors and just kind of see if he can do it?
That's one idea. I mean, I guess it would depend on what they're seeing from him, what he's working on in the minors. If he's pretty much a finished product down there and they've done all the tinkering they can do, then by all means, bring him up. If there's still more, you know, offensive tinkering, I mean, we've seen his swing is not exactly a conventional swing. He's got a leg kick in there. He's got a lot of moving parts. If they're working on something, probably the minors would be the best spot for that. But you could imagine that at some point, try it out in the majors, see what happens.
Getting to a point now where guys like Brandon Drury, Billy McKinney, almost kind of outside looking in a little bit with the Blue Jays lineup, no?
I think so. I mean, that's nearly a year since they've joined the organization. And we just haven't seen a ton. We've seen glimpses and flashes from both of those guys, and in both cases they have options, so it's not like there's a huge rush to reach some determination on them, but certainly they haven't impressed. They haven't reached that level of looking like a potential core piece for this team.
It's At the Letters, brought to you by the all-new 2019 Ford Ranger, featuring Terrain Management System, which has four selectable drive modes: normal, grass, gravel, and snow, mud and ruts, and sand, Ben.
That's legit. That is, wow, versatility from the Ford Ranger.
When you're out there driving on sand, the Ford Ranger can help you out with that. So the first half of this pod was kind of the positive half, and I feel like the back half is going to be more of the negative half, because we got to talk about the pitching. And when you talk about positives with this team, yes, look at that lineup, and even just recently, the Blue Jays scoring a lot more runs than they were earlier in the season. The plate appearances have looked a lot better. Pitching continues to be an issue, both in terms of the quality of pitching that the Blue Jays currently feature and the lack of pitching, not only at the big league level, throughout the organization. We could start with Aaron Sanchez, who is just about as lost as a pitcher can look right now on a big league mound. I mean, just if something bad can happen for him, it will, you know? And he even alluded to this the other day after his start. It's like,
just falling behind hitters, really. I mean, that's kind of been my thing all year is, you know, the free passes, those always kind of find a way to come back and haunt me. You know, after two guys get on, a couple hits here and there through the holes, and they're back in the game. We just got to be better.
If you're like in the shoes of the Blue Jays decision maker right now, Ben, what do you do with Aaron Sanchez for the rest of this season?
Well, it would depend on a few things. And my understanding is that Sanchez wants to start. So that would be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's not working right now. That's pretty clear. And a lot of that has to do with the ineffectiveness of his fastball, which right now is getting hit at a 328 clip when he hits it, 511 on base, 597 slugging. So those are like Bonds level numbers when Sanchez throws his fastball, which is not good.
He's
not
pitching to Barry Bonds every plate appearance.
Every time. Yeah, you can't have that happen with the 511 OBP. That's not good. And it really does go to show that hitters can square up 95. I mean, sometimes you hear that and it just sounds like a cliche, but Sanchez is throwing the ball still 94 miles an hour up to 97 and hitters are squaring it up. So it's not working. So I don't know. If there's some way that he can throw his curveball more, I would want to see that from him if I was the Blue Jays, because it's an effective pitch. It's an elite spin rate pitch. And that would be one potential way to get more out of him. I wouldn't be opposed to the idea of telling him to try airing it out for three innings and having Sam Gavilio ready. And part of that comes down to his struggles the second time through the order. It's been a rough spot for him. So basically, I would be open to tinkering with Aaron Sanchez. I'm not looking to trade him. If I'm the Blue Jays, like, no, you're not going to get anything.
You can't.
So there's no point to trading Aaron Sanchez right now. So basically, you're trying to get him on track. So I still think that, given that you're not trading him until at least the offseason, there's nothing wrong with having him in the rotation, as long as it's not wearing on him mentally, as long as there's still something that, you know, Pete Walker, Charlie Montoyo, Ross Atkins, that they can find something to say, hey, Aaron, try this, and then try it. That's what I would do, but I don't know exactly what that potential solution is.
Aaron Sanchez hates the idea of being a reliever right now. And you know what he might hate even more is your proposition to take him back to the piggybacking days of Lansing.
Right.
Because he hated that when that was going down. And now you're telling him to go back to like we're talking Justin Nicolino, Noah Syndergaard days.
Yeah.
Remember the whole plan with those guys? That's what you're thinking they should do with now Aaron Sanchez and Sam Gavilio.
Do you have any better suggestions than that? I mean,
my suggestion is one that he will also hate,
yeah.
And that's taking a little trip to the IL to get over any finger issues that he might be dealing with right now. And he's not sharing any of these going through, and he hates talking about that. But yeah, I mean, you know, pretty clearly the ball is not moving the way that it once did. The velocity's like down a little bit, not substantially, a little bit, but I think mostly it's the movement on his pitches that are allowing them to get hit the way they are, right? Like it's just the sinker just isn't dropping like it used to.
Right.
And his stuff just isn't as effective as it once was. So that suggests to me that, you know, maybe there's something going on with a grip issue, right? Or maybe there's something going on with his release. And you got to remember, you know, with all the finger issues that Aaron Sanchez went through over the last couple of years, he's like tweaked his delivery and tweaked his grips and like changed things. Like he might not even really remember how he threw the ball in 2016, right? Like he's been through so many changes. So he might just kind of be searching for it, or he might be going out there at less than full health, right? And I know it's a point of pride for him this season to make every start, and he has. That's a victory in and of itself for Aaron Sanchez. When you look at the last couple of years that he had coming off of that 2016 season, it is a bit of a small victory that I don't have in front of me, but you know, he must have made the second most starts on the team to Marcus Stroman. I mean, he is, you know, out there every 5 days taking the ball, and that's not something that he was able to do the last couple of years. So he wouldn't want to go on the IL, but I wonder if like a couple weeks, just get, you know, rest up anything that's bothering you, get a mental reset, just a mental break from the grind of the season, and watch some film and tinker with some things and work on some stuff in bullpens and try to get back to a place where you're just more confident in what you're taking to the mound.
That makes some sense. Sanchez tied with Stroman 18 starts as we record this for the most on the team.
Right. There was a time where Blue Jays fans were like, man, can this guy just pitch?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And he has pitched, but just not well at all. And you know, you look at just some of the numbers. He's been hit hard. He's allowing home runs. He's walking more than one batter for every two innings pitched, and he's not striking guys out. So it's not just a product of, oh, every time, you know, he walks a guy, he comes around to score. Every time he allows a ground ball, it finds a way through the infield. His FIP is 5.5. Like, he's just not been effective this year. And there is a chance that the Blue Jays won't get anything for Aaron Sanchez. I mean long-term. Like, this might be one of those Josh Donaldson situations where it just kind of peters into way less than it could have been. You know, who knows what happens with Merriweather? That's another topic. But, you know, with Stroman, it's pretty clear that if he stays on this course, they're going to get something, or they're going to have the chance to get something. They should. With Sanchez, I don't know if they're going to get that chance. And that's a big responsibility now for Pete Walker and for Atkins in the front office to try to find something, basically find which pitches are effective. How can he use his pitches to be more effective? Because he's probably not going to gain velocity at this point, and the grip issues that he's battled for years now probably aren't going to go away. And that's a really, really important thing for a pitcher. When you think about grip and, you know, the advantages that pitchers get when they use pine tar on their fingers, like, that helps you spin the ball. It helps you grip the ball and command the ball. And Sanchez right now is kind of going in the opposite of that, where he has less grip than he would ideally have.
That's what he's got to start doing. He's got to start loading the ball. That's what he's got to do.
Let's see it. Honestly.
He's got to get that glob of sunscreen and resin and pine tar on the old forearm or on the brim of the cap.
Foreign substance. Go for it.
But yeah, you make a good point that, you know, yeah, the Blue Jays have a lot of time and effort and resources invested in Aaron Sanchez. Like, since they drafted him almost a decade ago, right? Like, they have, you know, poured a lot of development into him. They were very cautious with his innings load and his workload. And, you know, you're like, remember the days of, you know, like, we were thinking about his innings and stuff, right? So, like, anything that the Blue Jays do with Aaron Sanchez going forward, like, they aren't going to make any rash decisions. It's not just going to be like, all right, you're going to the bullpen. If that decision is made, like, it's going to be really well thought out, and he's going to have to buy into it, and probably his agent's going to have to buy into it, and, like, everybody's going to have to, like, not to use the C word, collaborate on this decision. Like, it's not just going to be, oh, let's just try this and see if it works, because you don't want to screw him up anymore. The Blue Jays have a lot invested in him. Part of that, like you mentioned, the Blue Jays would love to get something for him at some point, and they'd love to spend these, basically the next 12 months. They have 12 months remaining with which to get something for him, right? So they've got 12 months to fix him up and get him back into an asset that somebody will be willing to pay something for again, because I can't even imagine that they're, who's trying to trade for Aaron Sanchez right now? His value as an asset is that it's nadir. You got to hope this is the nadir. You got to hope that you can build that thing back up. So part of it's as an asset. Part of it's because I think people in Blue Jays organization genuinely want him to succeed. Anybody who's been around him over his career knows, like, he's a very passionate individual. Like, he's a good person, man. Like, he's a good guy to talk to about the game. He's a guy who really cares about his career and works on his craft. And, like, him and Pete Walker have a tight relationship over the years that is, like, subsisted through regimes of, you know, Blue Jays management. So there's so much invested in this. I understand the thought process of putting him in the bullpen, just kind of what we're dancing around here, but I just don't think that now is the right time. And I just, you know, maybe you revisit that in the offseason. You say, hey, you got one more year to go before free agency. Maybe it makes the most sense for you to try to give this a go as a high leverage reliever. You benefit because maybe you're going to end up getting a pretty decent contract out of it in free agency. We benefit because we get this, you know, reliever who hopefully can come in and air it out and throw with a bit more velocity. And now you're healthy and you're not putting as much stress on your fingers as often and da 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 da. I just don't think that a decision to put him in the bullpen right now is going to be made rashly.
Yeah, I agree. And nor should it. And I don't think that the needs of the major league club should really impact that, even as they try to patch together a rotation right now. If you had to, you could call up a Thomas Pannone or find ways to get through the innings of the season. So I think you're really focused on Sanchez and trying to build him up into something. And thankfully, the Blue Jays are at a point now where other teams around the league, they don't care about his ERA. They don't care about the fact that, you know, he's allowed X number of hits. Really, it's such a granular commodity that they're looking for. They're looking for guys who can get swing and miss with a curveball, who can get swing and miss with a fastball, who have command. And right now, Sanchez only has one of those things, which is the curveball, no command and no fastball. And I don't think he's probably ever going to be a pinpoint command guy. But if they can get his fastball back, or get him to use his curveball more, then maybe you have the ingredients that another team would say, hey, we'll take this and try to turn it into something different than what he has been giving the Blue Jays.
You throw him out there and you let him continue pitching. That's just what you keep doing now every 5 days. It might not look great all the time, but like you said, there's still flashes of something in there. It's just not the time to give up on a guy like Aaron Sanchez. Marcus Stroman, on the other hand, continues to just pitch lights out, just being great. He's going to go to his first All-Star game here in a couple of weeks. One of the better starting pitchers available on the trade market. Marcus Stroman, 30 days from now, not going to be a Toronto Blue Jay unless something insane happens.
I agree.
And I think that he is probably their best commodity at the trade deadline over Ken Giles. If you're acquiring Ken Giles, I don't know if there's a team out there that's acquiring him to be their closer. You're probably acquiring Ken Giles to like be your eighth inning guy, right? Or come in and throw 100 miles an hour in the eighth, like as you try to build your nuclear bullpen for the playoffs. So you're just getting a lot more out of Marcus Stroman. So like, I just think as the Blue Jays head to the trade deadline, kind of the power rankings of the value of their trade pieces, Marcus Stroman, Ken Giles, Cliff, and then like Daniel Hudson, Freddie Galvis.
Yeah, maybe Smoke is in that group.
Yeah,
you know, depending on that. But you know, historically, you don't see teams trade first baseman for a ton at the trade deadline. No. Galvis, yeah, could be a useful piece potentially. Hudson, I think he'll be traded. I think Hudson would be an interesting pickup for someone. He's doing pretty well.
You can get you a Corey Copping, maybe a Jacob Wagasback.
That will be the exact same deal that will happen. They'll get someone's 20th best prospect for Daniel Hudson.
It was a nice piece of business by the Blue Jays, picking him up at the end of spring, right? You know, and bring him in. He's been like really under the radar, like a crucial part of that bullpen.
Without a doubt, he's been key. Joe Biagini, another guy who's been pretty solid, kind of comparable to Hudson, and might draw a little bit of interest. But ultimately, it's Giles and Stroman. And I agree, there's a huge gulf between those guys and everyone else. And really, when you look at the league-wide trade market, I think Giles and Stroman are important pieces within that. And for different reasons. Stroman's a guy who can really help get you there. If you're a team on the edge and you know you need to replace your number five starter with a solid number three, Stroman could be your guy. Yeah. Whereas Giles could be an extra dynamic piece for a playoff team. Even a team like the Dodgers that knows they're going to be there, they could add Giles because in the World Series, you never have enough Ken Giles types.
No. And I do wonder if there's still some uncertainty from teams when it comes to Giles. Like, he's been great in Toronto, obviously, but I do wonder if, like, from an outside perspective, teams might say, okay, cool, like, you went to a team that might lose 100 times and pitched really well in, you know, Toronto, where there's, like, zero media attention this year. Like, teams haven't forgotten how things went in Houston.
Nowhere.
Right? Like, yeah. So if you're bringing him into, like, New York or a Boston or whatever, right, and you're going to the playoffs and you got a lot of attention, you probably have some questions about how that might play out.
Right. And regardless of what market size you're in, even if it's, you know, for argument's sake, Milwaukee, Tampa Bay, which probably would be fits for him on paper, then once you get to the World Series, which is the ultimate goal, then you're going to have all kinds of spotlights on you, even if you're playing in the trop. So yeah, I think that there would be questions there. I think in a different way, there would be questions about Marcus Stroman. And I think that a team that was doing its due diligence would likely come to the conclusion that Stroman is a really intense competitor and someone who would do everything that he could to go out there and pitch well. But he's a guy who doesn't shy away from controversy. He's very well known around the league, whether it's with Alex Cora or Dennis Eckersley or Tim Beckham. I mean, he has had a few run-ins over the years, and that would be a question that teams would ask. But ultimately, I think they'd come to the answer that Stroman's one of the best pitchers out there.
Like how he runs the gamut of manager to broadcaster to shortstop there, just like pissing off everyone.
Oh, yeah. No question. And that's not the end of the list. That was just, you know, the names I came up with on the top of my head. So, yeah, I think that there would be potential for that kind of a question. But let's face it, the Astros traded for Roberto Osuna last year, and the questions around a guy like that were way worse and way more serious than, Stroman's not afraid to chirp someone on Twitter.
Talk about uncertainty with Roberto Osuna, a guy who like pitched in the minors, I guess, a couple times with the Blue Jays, right? But like hadn't pitched at a big league level in how long? Like, how were you supposed to know like where even he was at mentally, right? And you're going to bring him into this like pressure cooker of a playoff race and then the literal playoffs, on a team with like World Series aspirations after everything that he had been through that year, everything of his own creation and of completely his own fault. But like, that was a risk.
Yes, it definitely was. And yet the Blue Jays got a pretty good return for that. You know, you could argue, was it full value or not? But the Astros still were willing to pay a lot to get Roberto Osuna, and that suggests to me that other teams would have had similar interest if it wasn't Houston. And that, you know, as much as we heard from guys like Farhan Zaidi and Dave Dombrowski who said they weren't interested, I imagine that there would have been another GM or two who would have paid something pretty significant to get a closer of that caliber.
I will mention that, you know, some people might look at Eric Sogard as a guy who might get traded. My understanding is that there's not really anything out there right now for Eric Sogard. Teams are, you know, pretty aware of what he is. Like, it's well established over his career. He's having a great year. Like, absolutely. And great clubhouse guy, and like, could be a good fit on like a National League club, play a couple positions for you, but there really isn't anything out there for him right now. It's just kind of a nice story for the Blue Jays this year. And that's about it, because the Blue Jays, like, the rebuild is pretty much turned over, you know? Like, they're running out of kind of like the veteran assets that they would, you know, be able to trade away for packages or to, you know, try to inject youth into this team. That's why it's so crucial that they nail the Stroman trade in particular. I mean, obviously the Giles one as well, but I think the Stroman one's the big one because, you know, controllable starter, all the reasons that we mentioned about why he's such an attractive commodity at the deadline. Be great to get some pitching, be pretty good to get some pitching, but you can't really dictate what's going to be out there for you. Like, it's possible that it's a position player return, and then the Blue Jays have to kind of pivot into, okay, this coming off season, how can we package some of these position player prospects to trade for young, high upside pitching, which is a difficult thing to do because that is one of the most valuable commodities in this game. And the situations where teams are looking to sell those pieces or where teams are so desperate for position players that they are going to give up some of their high upside pitching, it's rare.
I agree. They can't afford to back themselves into a corner because if the pitching offers out there aren't good, then you take the position players. You know, you just have to get talent because they still have enough time to move pieces around and adjust. We're not at the point where the Blue Jays need some finishing piece. So they need to go out there and just add the best talent they possibly can.
They certainly do. That's going to be it for us here at the Letters. That's Ben Nicholson Smith. He's on Twitter at BNicholson Smith. Our producer's Amal Delich. Get him on Twitter at AmanDelic. My name's Arden Zwelling. You can read us as always at sportsnet.ca. We'll be with you from here until the end of the season, both in writing at sportsnet.ca and here on At the Letters. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.